Hello, and welcome to episode number 23 of Soft Spot. I am Chelsea Hamishon, the Global Soft Foundation Director of Marketing. Episode 23 is Michael Jordan's number, and that's officially all I know about basketball. But today's podcast is luckily not about basketball. It's about the documents recovered from Osama bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad, and more specifically, the lessons learned from them. We had the opportunity to talk about this with a true leading expert in the field, and you'll get why I emphasize true if you listen till the end, Dr. Nelly Lahoud. Dr. Lahoud is a senior fellow for international security at the New America think tank in Washington, D.C., and she's done tons of research on the evolution of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Our conversation today took place right after she did a presentation on the bin Laden documents, so you'll hear us reference that once or twice. And then she generously took some time to talk to me and Megan Keeler-Pettigrew, the GSF COO, about that presentation and even more details. So here is that conversation with Dr. Nelly Lahoud.
And then if we want to break it down...
Global Soft Foundation.
My immediate reaction was,
this
is awesome.
Cyber Professional Community. Association for Special Operations.
You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to Soft Spot.
Well, thank you, Nelly Lahoud, who's here with us at the New America, Arizona State, Global Soft Foundation, and U.S. Army War College Annual Soft Policy Forum.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, there's just a few organizations involved, obviously. So Nelly, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
And when I asked Nelly to do the podcast, her response was immediate and basically said anything for the soft community. So I know that you're someone that appreciates the soft community and what they've done. For U.S. and global security. So I loved getting your response. Thank you.
If I may show off as well, I am a holder, a proud holder of a Green Beret from a friend who designated me as an honorary member of the third group.
That's amazing.
Wow. I am one of your biggest fans.
Wow, so. That's incredible. That's amazing. Well, I really enjoyed your presentation. You've done a lot of analysis of the papers that were confiscated, taken as a result
recovered,
of the...
Yes.
Recovered, thank you, better word, from the May 2011 raid in Abbottabad. Maybe you could just start pretty broadly with what were your major conclusions after reviewing the bulk of the documents that have recently been declassified and released?
I've been working on these documents for a very long time. I was at West Point at the Combating Terrorism Center at the time when the first 17 documents were declassified through the Combating Terrorism Center. And I was the lead author of one of the report that analyzed them. And as you know, there were subsequent declassifications by the ODNI. And then more recently, in November 2017, the CIA declassified the remaining documents. And I have now read all of them. And the internal communiques, and they amount to about 6,000 pages in Arabic. It's really challenging to say what my findings are. There is something new on every page. Mm-hmm. But I do think that this is what is really revealing and what is important about these documents is that really we are listening in on Al-Qaeda. And this is something that... As far as intelligence is concerned, this is a prize, and so it is. It's been, and that's why I say there is something new on every page. Sometimes we don't just get the final letter that was sent, between various Al-Qaeda leaders, but we also get the notes of bin Laden, the things that did not make it into the final letter. you know, and so you get to appreciate a variety of angles of how the work was taking place. The impression that I have overall about Al-Qaeda, it's an organization whose capabilities were highly depleted, but its enthusiasm was not diminished. Mm-hmm. Its aspirations were very, very strong. It's I guess, in some respects, the weaknesses that we may consider to be weaknesses of its inability to act was also a strength, because this is how it managed to survive and to maintain, you know, the leadership, quite a lot of their leadership. Yes, the Abbottabad raid was a great success from the United States perspective, but you could also say the same thing about Al-Qaeda, in the sense that bin Laden was able to evade capture for nearly a decade. Ayman al-Zawahiri, his successor, continues to be at large. So, you know, they were doing certain things right in order to be able to maintain themselves as an organization.
Were there a few different, I guess, if you were categories or buckets of the documents that you could, for listeners, what were kind of the main categories of documents that were?
So what I did is when I read the documents, I've got this file that enables me to kind of classify or code. Mm-hmm. I coded for about 23 themes. Mm-hmm. You know, on Yemen, on Somalia, on Iraq, on the Taliban, on Pakistan, on Iran, on Saudi Arabia, Gaza, West Africa. You know, there were many, many themes on CT measures, on operational planning. So that's why it is really very difficult to give you. You know, we can talk for, you know, 3 to 4 days, if you like, nonstop, right. And I can tell you, you know, you can press the play button and I won't stop. But that's why it's very difficult to narrow it down to one single answer.
So one of the themes you talked about in your presentation today was about the effect of drone strikes. And I'm not sure if this was a quote or just you, that the drones were an insurmountable problem for Al-Qaeda.
You know, it's if you think on one level, is it easy to evade them? Absolutely. They knew exactly what they needed to do. But what they needed to do really is to be in hiding for most of the time. To be now, this is very challenging for a group overall. I mean, a group is not just about leaders and operatives. It's also about fighters and so on. So in some respects, you'll find that the group, Al-Qaeda, may be disciplined, but they were in an environment where they were not supposed to be overt. They were actually covert. They were hiding. Even in North Waziristan, they were hiding. Mm-hmm. Not everybody knew that who was who or who's who there and who was present. So they adopted really very important and stringent security measures. But at a time where there were many floods of various foreign fighters coming in from different groups, different nationalities, different ethnicities, and they were all kind of operating in the open. And the issue with the drone is that if one person is irresponsible with his security measures, then when the drones strike, then he's not just the only victim. It becomes widespread. The other thing is also about the drones is that, as to use their language, the area was infested with spies. And we know that once a spy was captured, he would be talking about 6 or 7 other spies. They would, you know, that they would find out as a result. So on one level, you have this culture of you need people en masse to be taking stringent security measures, and that is really very difficult to be done. Imagine your daily reality is such, and so from that perspective, it was very, very, very difficult to control. And many of these groups did not really join the jihad to, to be in hiding.
They right. Wanted, they wanted yeah, to you fight. Were saying that this about is, the essence is, of being a jihadi. I mean,
yes,
to
I mean,
fight.
Exactly. I mean, you have the leaders, you have the ideologues, but you have the operatives. You can count on them. But even those who were very impressive, they found themselves sometimes committing mistakes and making mistakes. So it was very, very challenging. And it's not just me who said that it is insurmountable. It is, as I said, I quoted Al-Qaeda's number three at the time, Atiyah, who seemed despairing about the situation. So it seemed to be a very, very challenging problem.
What did you find about collaboration with Al-Qaeda, with other terrorist groups, other proxy, you know?
This is a very interesting question, and I think at a certain point I'll have something a little bit more meaningful to say when I start writing on that. But my immediate reaction, my initial impression, they were very wary of everybody. Mm-hmm. On one level, they would connect, and with respect to security measures, they were connecting with some groups, either Waziris or Pashtus. Sometimes they're not really say who they are, but at some points they were able to kind of connect with each other. But at other times they were not able to, and you can tell that everybody seemed to think suspicious of each other. You know, we're talking today about the Talibans and so on. Not all the Talibans are equal, and we certainly see that in Al-Qaeda's letters. They were wary. Of that, even the Taliban, they were wary. It's, you know, when we think about the Fatah or North Waziristan specifically, you know, in the past, I would have thought, you know, they had, you know, the sort of the trust and the loyalty of the tribes, but it's much, much more complicated than that. No, they were trying to hide, and not everybody was supposed to know that Al-Qaeda, who's who in Al-Qaeda and who was there and so on. So it was much more complicated, and it still is very complicated for Al-Qaeda in that environment. It's not easy.
Can you explain what the security committee is for Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, so this is something that they set up around December 2008 in order to counter the drones. I mean, they were losing brothers
that was,
every day.
Okay,
that was provoked by the drones.
Okay.
And it was specifically set up in order to see what to do about what was going on. And the report that I cited was written in May 2010, and it discusses at length what they had done in their 18 months of existence.
You mentioned earlier that there was one letter in which a leader was saying, basically, hey, we don't need any more jihadis in Afghanistan. At what point was that?
So this letter was actually written in January 2011. However, he had already made public statements, which I had read without the documents, not with the documents. And at the time, it was actually, it was a letter called Al-Ajwiba fin Nafir, or meaning responses concerning the departure to jihad. And in that public statement, which is available to which was available before we had the others available, it's like kind of interesting. It was a Q&A with him that was posted on a jihadi website, and he was trying to be delicate. The Tatia, he was a very smart person, and he was killed 4 months after Bin Laden. He was trying to be delicate about, no, we don't need any more in Afghanistan. Yes. Money would be better, but if you must go to jihad, go elsewhere. Now, you know, when you read the internal documents to kind of put perspective or give you some context on what was going on, you realize the problem is we can't take them in. I mean, they are flooding here. We don't have the capacity. And in that letter, he says, you know, what we need to do is we really need to educate them. We need to train them. We need to do all sorts of these things. We cannot take it. We don't have the capacities anymore. So you have this landscape that can no longer absorb new people. And here we are, having to, imagine put yourself in their shoes, having to take on board all these enthusiastic newcomers who want to go and fight. All they want them to is to hide. By the way, just between parentheses, and that'll give you a little bit more about where I'm coming from. I also study jihadi a cappella, which is like kind of their, they're not songs because they're not meant to, it's unlawful to use musical instruments in Islam. So their chants and you know, they cover many themes, and they're mainly the purpose of a cappella or these chants for jihadis is to incite people to join the jihad, or, you know, talk about martyrdom, the virtue of martyrdom, and so on and so forth. When I was working on that security measures and on the drones, all I could picture, can I imagine them chanting about the virtue to hide? It doesn't work. Right. It's like you know, you can but this is part of
really inspiring.
Yeah. Exactly. This is part of the jihadi culture. You want them to act. You want them to fight. You want them. This is their greatest asset. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, that's not what's needed here. And, you know, I'm very familiar with jihadi ideological literature. And all of a sudden, I found myself disoriented because all of a sudden I'm finding all these elements that I hadn't seen being discussed at length in jihadi literature. So we know about the emphasis on jihad, on fighting, and so on. And that security committee, the very first four pages of their 18-page report, is making a case about security in the Quran and in the Islamic tradition, why it is important and why it goes hand in hand with jihad. Now, this was not something that I had read before.
Ever heard before, right?
And your average jihadi like me wouldn't have read it before, and so it was disorienting for me, and I'm sure it was disorienting for others. And as I also noted in my talk, in my presentation, that you know, if you want to engage in security, you need to be spying as well. Mm-hmm. You can't combat espionage if you're not going to do your due diligence and collect information, and that is unlawful in Islam.
Right.
And so they, you know, there is a passage which I didn't cite in my presentation. There's a passage where they're kind of trying to defend what they're doing, like, you know, we're not doing, you know, what, you know, the surveillance of the tyrants, they said, is not the same as the surveillance that we do. The tyrants is, you know, the tyrants' objective is to do things against God's wishes, whereas we do things in order to become closer to God. And so what this paragraph tells you is that they were on the defensive.
Yeah,
they're being accused of spying. And here you have
to justify it. Yeah, they were desperate to justify it.
So there is a specific cultural setting that you need to have for proper security measures, that was really a challenge for Al-Qaeda and other jihadis. And you can tell, you know, when they say, oh, but people have their own interpretations, yata'awwalun, and I know exactly what they're saying. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, what are you doing to us? You know, what do you think yourself you're doing? You're intruding on us, and so on. And you can, you know, sometimes they don't need to be explicit, and you're able to guess.
Mm-hmm. Read between the lines.
You can read between the lines, right. Absolutely.
Is that one of the reasons this, you know, prohibition on spying, also a reason where or why you don't see intelligence sharing among groups?
I mean, you know, I've heard about problems of intelligence sharing in amongst different U.S. interagencies, and this is so Al-Qaeda would say it would probably have good conversations to share. But what was very particularly revealing for me in that report is, I'm sure you remember the operation that killed seven CIA officers. That was news to Al-Qaeda. They heard about it from others. And in that committee, what they wanted is, we requested more information, they said, so that we would benefit. And they refused to share with them. Now, it is you know, these deep suspicions. But also, the jihadis do not all share the same worldview. We know, for instance, from Al-Qaeda's letters Al-Qaeda is a very strategic and pragmatic group, and their disposition is to think well of Muslims in the first place, but they are watchful. And so from their perspective, you know, they're happy to help out whenever they can. So, for instance, Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, they got a few excerpts of it That's in September. I think it was published in September 2010. And what alarmed them is that the CIA had identified 150 training camps and facilities for the Taliban, and that alarmed bin Laden. He wanted everybody to evacuate from North Waziristan. But he went on to say, please make sure that you share this with the jihad, with the Taliban brothers, so that they would not frequent these places. So you can see Al-Qaeda going out of its way to share whenever it could help. But that was not reciprocated. And you see quite a lot of divisions in terms of worldview between Al-Qaeda and various other groups. At one point, for instance, the Pakistani Taliban, which, you know, they were Al-Qaeda was stuck with them. But you see that at one point they were highly concerned about the indiscriminate killings of the Pakistani Taliban, their attacks in mosques and in the marketplace. And they wrote them a letter saying that they would threaten to dissociate with them in public if they continued, if they didn't change their ways. But back to the drones, bin Laden, in one letter, he's saying, you know, advise them and counsel them. And you can see Atiyah saying, kind of reaching the end of his tether, and he says something to the effect, we counsel them a lot, but you know how they are. Mm-hmm. And then he says, well, the bitter reality teaches best. Now they know that everybody has been targeted, and the enemy is targeting everyone. So he was hoping that the bitter reality will teach them. So yes, Al-Qaeda was trying to do its best with others, but it was not reciprocated. Al-Qaeda felt quite vulnerable in its environment. They were concerned about news that the Taliban were negotiating with the Americans. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know how to read the Taliban themselves. So it's not a very simple, straightforward environment that they had to deal with.
Time for a quick break for some plugs. The first being for the fast approaching Global Soft Foundation Modern Warfare Week coming up in November. This event has two major parts. The first is Demo Days, which is taking place at the Range Complex, about 30 minutes outside of Fort Bragg in North Carolina. This is going to be a really cool hands-on event with a live fire range, vehicle test track, and more, and that's happening on 19 and 20 November. Part two of the week will take place on Fort Bragg and feature an industry expo alongside of the Modern Warfare Symposium, which is co-sponsored by us and the U.S. Army Special Operations Command, better known as USASOC. And that's happening from 21 to 22 November. So please visit globalsoftsymposium.org to learn more about that event and how you can get involved. For my second plug, I do want to highlight a GSF corporate partner, Air Center Helicopters, or ACH. ACH provides global expeditionary aviation services with dedicated professional customer service and unparalleled dependability. ACH was established in 1986 and has been supporting the Department of Defense, Department of Interior, National Science Foundation, and commercial companies since, with a perfect safety record. Specializing in expeditionary flight operations, ACH mission profiles include shipboard testing, logistics, tactical training, disaster relief, casualty evacuation, and personnel recovery for a diverse client base. So learn more about ACH at air.center. That's air.center. Pretty easy one, but there will be a link in the episode description anyways. Thanks, ACH. And now back to the show.
Another relationship you have written about was Al-Qaeda and Iran. Mm-hmm. And what were the conclusions you drew in that?
Well, I started out from the premise because when the documents were released in November 2017, there was quite a lot of press around it that Iran was enabling Al-Qaeda. And this is both a problem that both the Trump administration as well as the Obama administration had done. So, for example, the DNI director, James Clapper, had once stated that he thought that there was a marriage of convenience between Al-Qaeda and Iran. And I found out after reading all the documents now, particularly the documents by former Al-Qaeda detainees in Iran, including bin Laden's family, that there was no marriage of convenience. And Al-Qaeda did not consummate that marriage, if there was ever a marriage of convenience. They didn't trust the Iranians. The Al-Qaeda, they were imprisoned in Iran. We have letters from the former detainees. So there is a lot of misinformation out there about the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iran. And I didn't find not a single reference in the source that suggests to me that there was collaboration between Iran and Al-Qaeda to carry out terrorism. They were, so as I said, there were detainees in Iran, including bin Laden's family. He had six of his children from his first wife there, and he had his second wife, Khairiya, and their son, Hamza, there. So you can imagine, and he wanted, you know, he cares about his family a great deal. But he also cares about the other Al-Qaeda members there. And remember, when they went to Iran, and this is where what the documents tell us, when they went to Iran, they went after the fall of the Taliban regime, and at the time, Pakistan was arresting people left, right, and center. They had no choice but to go to Iran, and they had hoped that they would be able to live in a clandestine fashion in Iran. And initially, that was the case. Mm-hmm. And one letter says betrayal, quote unquote, led to the capture of many of Al-Qaeda. Another letter makes it clear that those who are in Iran, you know, they are there only as prisoners. However, Al-Qaeda was able to use territories in Iran to smuggle personnel as well as money, but they were doing so in a clandestine fashion. And those operatives who were tasked to, get money or smuggle money, they were prepared to kill themselves. Mm. And that was the advice that, you know, read a certain treatise on the importance of committing suicide, because it was you didn't want the enemy to know Al-Qaeda's secrets. So that relationship that is painted as if somehow there's an intimate relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iran has no basis in the documents whatsoever. And frankly, those who make it do underestimate. Why Al-Qaeda is a formidable enemy, and I think they miss that point.
How many people besides you do you think have read all of the recovered documents?
So I'm sure when they were recovered, you know, the intelligence community was pouring over them. Mm-hmm. Initially, they put out translation of some of the documents, mm-hmm. and what this told me, some of it, I have to say, my immediate reaction, since I've been working on the documents, is that they must have been pretty good in terms of looking at the documents from actionable intelligence. Mm-hmm. Many of the names that I was finding in the letters, they were soon captured thereafter. So for actionable intelligence, I'm sure we have some impressive people. In terms of content analysis, I was not impressed at all by the translation, and I've not used it. The available translation at all. I translate my own, and that's understandable, that they must have had a division of labor, mm-hmm. in terms of mm-hmm. The documents. And so there were certain documents that they didn't connect mm-hmm. together. So, for instance, one of the most important documents that we have about Al-Qaeda, Iran reaching out to Al-Qaeda, that I dated back to 2004. It had been, it's a two-page document. It's handwritten. One of these pages was declassified in 2015. The other was declassified in 2016. And the key terms on that are the same on both pages are translated differently. So they declassified them as two documents where it was actually one single letter. They didn't put one and one. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, this isn't to, you know, on one level, I don't want to do some kind of false modesty here. Mm-hmm. What I've done is I've been working really, really hard. But in some ways, I have it easier in the sense that I've read everything by myself and I'm able to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes they speak in riddles, sometimes they speak in codes. Unless you're able to make the connections.
See the patterns.
And see the pattern, you're not going to be able to do it if you are several people working mm-hmm, on right. these documents. So in some respects, I have it easier.
Doesn't sound easy.
Yeah, I mean, 6,000 pages?
Having said that, look, when I started doing, I put a file there, like I printed them all, and they were all double-sided for the environmentalists out there.
Yeah.
But I put a pile that would have been probably around 35 inches. And I started, you know, another file of those that, you know, a pile that was of those that I read and I coded. And I sent a photo of this to a friend. She's with a measuring tape. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Do you know what the measuring tape is?" And she said, "No, what are you talking about?" And I said, "I am measuring my productivity and I'm going to proclaim myself as the political scientist of the year."
Yes.
And she knows that I can barely count to 10. And she's a quantitative political scientist herself. So she came back and she said, "You're in a league of your own, my friend."
Yes.
But then by the time I finished reading the documents, I wanted more.
Wow.
My initial point, I was just like quite sad. I'd be working till, you know, I'd be reading and coding till about 10:30 p.m. most days, and I would only stop because my eyes were fatigued. Mm-hmm. But it was really thrilling to be able to go through the documents. So it's not as difficult as some might
find. I
think
many people would disagree with you.
But
it must have been fascinating.
What were any long-held assumptions that were corroborated by the documentation?
I'm sorry, I'm going to sound a bit of a snob, but many of the assumptions are undermined by I think the way we have studied the subject has missed much of what the documents say. And look, there are many leading non-experts out there, and I often find that the people who write about documents are not the same ones who are reading the documents. And so I'm hoping that people would take these documents seriously. And I'm hoping that the big egos in the field would look at these documents to learn, not to prove, to search for what it is that they got right and ignore what they got wrong. I think, you know, I know that I have changed my views on certain things, and I'm hoping that people will look at these documents as a way to learn about what was going on.
So for people who want to learn more about this and hear more from you, what's the title of your book and where can people
Well,
get
I
it?
Am still at the beginning
writing this one. Okay.
Yes, I am.
But you have written previous books.
I have. Okay. Yes. Hopefully, I mean, there'll be things that I'll miss, but I'm gonna cover as much of the themes that we find. Mm-hmm. In the papers, and wish me luck.
Yeah,
good definitely luck. Good Did luck, you, and let us know when it comes out.
Did you just use the term leading non-expert? Did you say that? I really like that. I've never heard that before.
I actually wrote it in a book that I wrote in that I published in 2010. It's entitled "The Jihadi's Path to Self-Destruction," and I found it. You know, at the time I wrote in that book that this is not going to be, you know, for people who study in the field of terrorism, because I had such a negative view of the terrorism field because of all the leading non-experts that I was you know, listening to and so on. But then you know, by the time I finished that book, I get this job at West Point in the combating terrorism center of all names.
Yes.
And here I am. But then I came to realize, you know, I learned quite a lot about terrorism studies from teaching in you know, terrorism courses. And I came to my pleasant surprise that there is a rich field in terrorism studies. People have been writing since the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, one of my biggest fan is Martha Crenshaw at Stanford. And we had her at one point at West Point, and she came to present a lecture. And for those who are listening, the most important work they will ever read about terrorism is Martha Crenshaw's The Causes of Terrorism. There is nothing, you know, we're all a footnote to that article. I think it was published in 1981. But no, there are some fantastic scholars in the terrorism field. And I'm glad that I got to know about some of the great work that people in the field of terrorism do. But somehow, jihadism seemed to have been a field that, as I said, has many leading non-experts.
Yeah. So forgive me. I'm going to start using that in other areas, I think. I just like that term.
So long as I don't have to quote you, because it's mine originally.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for joining
us
today.
Yes, thank you.
It was
really my pleasure.
I appreciate the extra time. So thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.
Soft Spot is brought to you by the Global Soft Foundation, a 501c3 based in Tampa, Florida. If you're new to us, you can find out more about the foundation at gsoft.org. That's Gulf Sierra October Foxtrot.org.